Welcome to A New Lens with Common Good Capital, where we talk with investors, RIAs, fund managers, and philanthropists about their experiences within the different impact investing themes, as well as explore the power of stewardship and capital. I'm your host, Jeff Schaefer, CEO of Common Good Capital. Today, we have the pleasure to get to know Patrick Fisher. Patrick was an early adopter and a practitioner of impact investing. We'll learn more about that story. Patrick is founder and managing partner of Creation Investments. Creation Investments is a global alternative investment manager and a leading impact investor focused on financial services and the financial inclusion for the un or underbanked. So, Patrick, thank you.
Thanks, Jeff. Great to be here.
So, we must have met. I am in one of your funds, so we must have met. I don't know, 8 years ago.
Seven, eight years ago, exactly.
Yeah, so it's fun to connect. So, why don't you start off and give our listeners a little bit of background, where you grew up, where you went to school, and then just a high level of your career.
Well, I was born and raised in Southern California, born in LA. My father actually left before I was born, so I was raised by a single mom. Grew up in Orange County and didn't have a lot, so I had to focus on hard work.
Where in Orange County did you grow up?
I grew up in Mission Viejo, actually.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
My mom's still out there, but... But yeah, I got involved in Boy Scouts, and my Boy Scout leader was a massive influence in my life. Ended up going to college out in Indiana at Notre Dame, and then came to Chicago after studying computer science as well as philosophy and theology, and got a job at a bank, J.P. Morgan, here in Chicago, and ended up working in China for a couple of years. Coming back in 2003 during the SARS pandemic, so here we are in another. Pandemic, but that's really when I first found out that I love banks, and I don't know why we're all bank nerds here at Creation, but we love banks. But also, you know, by being in China, I saw kind of little shop after little shop that really couldn't get access to basic banking services like small business loans, for example. You know, at that time in China, the maximum you could borrow even on a credit card was $500. You know, it was heavily cash-based economy. And when I came back, I started to learn about microcredit, microfinance through charities and through other forms. This guy, Muhammad Yunus, won the Nobel Peace Prize. You know, all the light bulbs and the fireworks were going off in my head about banking and combined with a mission to serve the poor and to bring people out of poverty, but through market forces. It was everything I believed in capitalism and from my faith. And so all these connections were going on. And really what did it for me is I ended up pulling out Muhammad Yunus. His bank is called the Grameen Bank, if you're familiar, in Bangladesh. And I pulled out the financial statements in 2004 or five, and they had a 38% return on equity. And I just thought, hey, if I can, you know, win the Nobel Peace Prize and get a 38% return on equity, that sounds like the kind of banking I like to be in. And in particular, is again, connecting it to my childhood, you know, supporting women to increase their income really resonated with me, thinking about my own mother and how many women are obliged or forced even to work and provide for their kids, and just how fundamentally good that is to get behind people that are resourceful and just need access to the basic tools of the day to improve their livelihoods and increase their income. So I bought in big hook, line, and sinker. And finally, in 2007, left J.P. Morgan to start Creation Investments. So we've been doing this for 15 years. Again, as you said, all we do is financial services for the poor and the unbanked in emerging markets, not frontier markets, but we'll talk about that. And my wife has been amazing and such a supporter. And we've been married through this whole time and have three kids, live here in the city of Chicago. We've got a dog and love him too. So yeah, it's a lot of good things in life.
So one quick question for you in regards to impact investing. In 2007, you start Creation. I mean, impact investing, the phrase, I think, was 2006, if I got my math right. So just give us a snapshot of impact investing today then to today. I mean,
yeah,
you've got to see a massive change.
Yeah, for sure. And I think, you know, financial services has been the tip of the spear here, I think, for a lot of organizations. I think a lot of folks maybe that listen to this podcast had already been donating to microcredit and microfinance, whether it be through faith-based organizations like World Relief and World Vision and Opportunity International, or on the more secular side through CARE and other forms, and seeing economic development as a fundamental good. You know, development finance institutions like the World Bank and IFC had been doing this. And really the Europeans got involved fairly early in the mid-2000s, launching private credit funds, debt funds, to get behind banking and the development of banks and financial systems in these markets that we're talking about today. So you have this great sort of stepstone between from charities and NGOs to then maybe, you know, low return pools of capital that were really looking to get behind banking. Since then, as you know, Jeff, you know, the whole mentality of how you use markets, business to address, again, big market opportunities and needs, in our case, the unbanked, but in other cases, it's the need for affordable housing or clean energy or other fundamental problems that we have in our world, but how to use our capital, not just where we donate, but our investment capital to solve those problems behind innovation, technology, people, processes. That's a very exciting thing. When we got started, we had the benefit of, again, the year of microcredit, I think was 2005 or six, if I remember correctly. So we had some tailwinds, but there was a lot of education that had to go into it. Now, I think, as you know all too well, there's, depending on your number, there's $100 trillion of ESG money. So now we need to educate the other way, which is what's real and what isn't, and what is maybe ESG versus yep. impact, what is thematic versus faith-based versus values, what is negative versus positive, all the things that you do for a living, you know, essentially helping people navigate now a variety of options.
How would you view creation and what you do? Is it ESG? Is it impact?
So we're very much focused on positive social impact, which is, again, not an exclusionary screen of avoidance of certain issues, which has a role in every portfolio, but actually about putting capital into businesses that directly achieve overall goals that we have. Now, within the private space, alternative investments like private equity and private credit, for us, the S is huge because our fundamental client, we have about 23 million customers in our portfolio companies today. We manage just under $2 billion, which is a real gift and blessing. But that client base is predominantly women, they're predominantly low income, and they're predominantly in India, Mexico, Peru, Chile, Brazil, Indonesia, in markets that really have this rising middle class that we want to help support in their path out of poverty and into opportunity. So the S is huge, the social is huge. And then the G is obviously huge as well. There's no better G in governance than private equity. We sit on boards, we own 90% of a bank in Peru. You know, that I don't know of a better G than that, than really being involved in the construction of policies and the hiring of people, in the enforcement of internal audit and practices, and launching new products that can really bless the client base. And then working on efficiencies to make your operation cheaper and faster and more responsive to the client, to pass all those benefits of wealth creation on to all parties. And that's really what we believe in. But to position ourselves, we're in that thematic space, financial inclusion. So what we do is financial services, knowing that that's a huge component to the overall problem of poverty. But it's not everything, you know, it's not a hospital. It's so, you know, but it may finance healthcare, but it doesn't create the healthcare apparatus that's required. It's not education, but it might finance education. It's not, you know, all sorts of other components need to come to the fore in order to really develop true economic opportunity. But fundamentally, you know, money is the blood that circulates in a body. And when that doesn't circulate, and when it doesn't get to certain places, the body atrophies or doesn't grow. And so that's the one power that banking has.
You know, thinking about serving the underbanked, or even you talked about affordable housing and jobs, pre-COVID, when I would talk about some of these issues here domestically, it didn't feel like impact if you were still providing those things. Mm-hmm. You know, you had to go overseas, essentially, in the mind of, I think that mentality has changed. And I actually think then it, then if you can do that same thing overseas, it's like, okay, now I really get it. But I've even seen it change here in the U.S. Have you seen any of that change?
Yeah, I'll also sort of feel around the room with you to try to find our way, because I think, you know, when I started, we were going through the financial crisis.
Yeah, that's right.
And that's a time where if you were to say, we need to give loans to people that can't access markets, people would say, for housing, for example, people would say, well, that's a little crazy. Didn't we just do that? And wasn't that a terrible result?
Yeah.
Where today, I think, you know, interestingly, again, post George Floyd and some of the reawakening and awareness of racial divides and socioeconomic inequity in our own society, to say, wow, if we could address redlining in our country and culture, we could really address some of the fundamental building blocks of poverty and wealth creation. And so now, you know, one of our latest investments, you may be familiar, Jeff, is in an affordable housing lender in India. And I think people get it today now that they wouldn't have gotten 15 years ago, ironically, that providing somebody who couldn't get a loan from a bank because of their gender, their religion, their geography, or even their kind of income, you know, these are borrowers, they don't have W-2s because they don't have a salary, but they have informal income. But by providing that family with a loan to build their own single family home is unbelievably powerful. So we get to be a part of that solution set today, where again, 15 years ago, housing loans were not something people were terribly eager to talk about. But I think actually through the financial crisis, there was an awareness that local community banks are so critical for the fabric of a community, for a small village or a town, that without a local community bank that provides capital and savings, that the town dies. And when these smaller institutions started to go under or falter or seize up during the financial crisis, I think small parts of America, for example, really felt that hard. And so it was an easy backdrop for us to say, this is how it is all the time in, you know, places in Mexico. This is how it is all the time in Northeast India in Uttar Pradesh. So we get to be the first capital provider that are, and we do that out of, you know, buying or investing in regulated banks, insurance companies, finance companies that use technology. So call them fintechs, but ours are regulated, profitable, and ready to grow, but they lack the kind of equity capital that they need to keep up with the growth.
I'm going to switch gears here a little bit and come back to you and kind of your career. Look, by all standards, at least from my perspective, you're not telling me this, but you've been very successful. You started out, you know, at a large bank, and you've now 15 years into this, you now manage, you know, $2 billion. So how would you best describe yourself in the context of where you're at in your life journey?
You know, I started the business creation 15 years ago, really out of a sense of calling, out of a sense of opportunity, because I was so excited to find the 38% return on equity that had mission, you know, interwoven into it. So really firmly believed there were these kinds of institutions out there. You know, making money ourselves was pretty secondary for ourselves as a family, but primary was really connecting these capital sources with the capital needs and providing a channel to do so, because I think I did meet people 15 years ago who, when I told them what we were up to, said, I've been looking for this. And that was really the driver. As I've developed, I mean, I've gotten better at building teams. Our team is incredible. I realize that's the biggest job that I have as a leader is actually building teams, not doing it myself, but building teams that do more, where really 1 + 1 = 3. Because of the people you pulled around. I've realized the power of technology and what we can leverage within our businesses and how that can help really reduce the transaction costs for our clients. and improve value there. And I do think, you know, for us, I think where I am now as a leader is just continuing to realize the power of focus. Again, I know you operate in all these different verticals and themes within impact, which I think are fabulous. But I really don't know the first thing about clean energy, and I shouldn't pretend to. And I just very much believe in the power of specialization. It's a theme of capitalism, actually, which is the ability to specialize and how much more value you drive for society by being a specialist. Now, of course, then that means we need all sorts of kinds of specialists. You don't want me doing surgery, right. But you really want somebody who's been to medical school and is the best of breed within their craft to be operating on you when the time comes. But you do want us and our team to be working on bank transactions, on securitizations, on placing debt capital, on equity raises, on IPOs like we've got coming up here in India again, on building technology that's built for the future. So that's what we do. So I think, you know, where I am as a leader is never believe more in the mission, never believe more in specialization and my role really to build out the team as we go forward.
Well, it's been fun to not only be along your journey for a small little piece, but then obviously just to follow and to see what you guys are doing. And actually, your quarterly reports, occasionally I will forward that on to my wife and my kids, and I will let them know and say, hey, read this. This is where a piece of our capital is. See this pie chart and see how they're lending capital to. And so that's been fun for the engagement part of my family to come alongside you and what your team does. So just know that it's made an impact in our lives, and it's been one of our stories as we transitioned in this impact investing space probably 8 years ago.
Yeah, that's great. Well, if I can interject on that, I am showing my kids a video of some of our farmers. We've invested in a company called Rashamandi in India that supports the farmer supply chain in silk and cotton. And just those farmers don't have the tools to trade with one another as they buy their raw inputs, and they don't have the cash to be able to afford discounts through bulk, et cetera. But I'm going to be showing my kids a video of our farmers tonight. That's one of our things we're doing to try to help them see how this works. But I've always been a little skeptical of sort of the videos and the pictures, because I've really tried to avoid selling poverty. You know, and I do think there's a lot of sort of that poverty tourism out there. And now I realize I did kind of throw the baby out with the bathwater, where people really do, just like you just did, Jeff, they really need to connect with the personal story, so that the numbers that we put out there about, you know, asset growth and loan quality and yield and other products, that they come into focus through people.
Yes.
And again, I sort of, shame on me for that. I was reacting a little bit to the NGOs that were early on in microcredit, that in some ways I felt like we're maybe almost taking advantage of the client base to raise money. And so we wanted to avoid that and only show bank metrics and ratios.
Right.
But bank metrics and ratios aren't the whole story either. So I've come a long way in that.
Well, it's funny, because when I speak, one of the things, and I need to frankly probably be more bold than this, but coming from the financial world that I did for the last 25 years, or it's all about the head. And so one of the things I've been trying to talk about is, look, we need to invest with our head, but we also can bring our heart in. And that does not mean that bringing your heart in, that you then have to prey on, you know, the poor, but it's a very delicate balance.
Yeah.
You know, my brother would be first to tell you, who does stuff in Rwanda, he's like, I don't want you thinking this is a sob story, you know? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We're doing this because it makes sense. And these men and women want to be invested in. They don't want to be treated any differently. There's a dignity that having somebody invest in you brings. I mean, I've got a deep passion for prison ministry, and I've been investing in some businesses run by formerly incarcerated. And I let people know, I go, I don't feel sorry for these men and women. I mean, I'm trying to help them, but I want to invest in them and treat them like I would any other investor.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's the fundamental shift in what we're trying to bring. Exactly what you just said is that our client base are not people to be pitied. They're brothers and sisters in the context of faith, perhaps, but they're people to be served. These are clients. I want to win their business. and for the long term. And that gives so much dignity and gives so much power to them rather than power for me. And it's really why I believe that a business model behind this actually delivers bigger and bigger social impact than a charitable model does. And there's still, again, you and I have talked over the years, but there's still room for charity within financial services, where you give your money, we ourselves give to the Democratic Republic of Congo. It is an uninvestable market when you look at the risks involved there. I don't think you'll ever get to a point where you say, oh, the upside is easily trumps the downside. It's at this point an uninvestable market. But these are people that need access to financial services, and you got to start building that capacity. But in the same vein, I want us to be active in places where we can use our investment capital, the other 90% of what we have and what we want to allocate, you through a business model, and that business model delivers more dignity than the charity model. And it's kind of how we see it. And again, I've talked about even people that look at the Bible, and the Bible has a obvious focus on the poor, to give to those in need. But then there's another concept in the Old Testament of gleaning, which gleaning is you have a field and you don't pick all the parts of it. You leave the corners of the field for people that can work, for them to be able to pick their own, produce or whatever it is from the field. So there's a work element, but that's, in my mind, the gleaning is a little like the buy one, give one model of social impact, which is you still make money out of your business, but you leave a little of your profits for the charitable aspect. But what we're really trying to do is make a loan to that person so they can buy their own field, and then help them make that field more productive so they can pay off the loan and own an asset. And then they're going to want a tractor and a house, and to help their kid go to school, and all these other needs that develop from that ownership standpoint. And that's real empowerment.
You may have already answered this question, but just because of what you do, but I'll throw it out there anyways. How are you personally, or what do you feel called as it relates to trying to change the world, whether that be big or whether it be small? Although I gotta be honest, what you guys are doing is having a big influence. So
I guess I'll answer this on a very personal level, which is I thoroughly and utterly believe that one must let go of a desire to change the world in order to be free to do so, if so called. You can talk about Mother Teresa, that we all know who she is, but she fundamentally just helped people die. She's from Albania, moved to India, should have been forgotten, but through a humility, we talk about her and revere her because she let go of her own plan for her life. And I really believe in that you really need to let go of that I'm going to change the world mentality, and maybe even go beyond that to say whatever I'm doing right now has impact and can be a part of changing the world. And whether it's known or unknown, or whether it has a lot of zeros behind it,
right.
or just a few, decimal points or cents, that I'm a part of changing the world just right around me. And I think there's example after example of a very small, relative to the whole world economy, but people that have been completely dedicated in their own community. So I really believe that you got to let go of that. And because of that, then you're free
Right.
to have, I guess the naivete to go out and say, let's go buy a bank in Mexico, which one of our board members reminded me of the other day, that I called him in early 2008 and said, I think we should go buy this bank in Mexico, and this is what we'll do. And he couldn't believe the moxie, I guess, or the, and it wasn't pride. It was just the glimmer in my eye of thinking we should do this. And
Right.
here's all the reasons why it made sense. But it's once you, the self-forgetfulness, the ego fades in the background, and then it all becomes about the work and does it make sense, and constantly questioning yourself, I think is a very healthy approach to life. So.
Okay, now this is a question that I've been dying to ask you, and no pressure, but just especially because of what you do. And so if you want to answer this personally and then maybe give some examples of what how you see it play out, that's fine too. But when did you realize the power of capital and maybe what does that mean to you?
Yeah, I really do think it was when I was in China. We got a bank license. JP Morgan got a local currency bank license that I was involved in Shanghai in early 2003 is when the license was issued. And that allowed us to lend in renminbi. And it was when I realized that our minimum loan would be about $50 million, which, you know, basically means that we weren't really going to be addressing all of these small, you know, corner shops and other folks. And frankly, that's what's led to a lot of the shadow banking that still exists in China, is that the big banks globally, but specifically in China, are not terribly focused on that small and medium size business. So, and that's, as we all know, the lifeblood of an economy. Mm-hmm. That's where job creation happens. That's where innovation happens. That's where wealth creation happens, really for that middle class. So I think I started to realize the power of that. And then when I came back to the States, I was doing my MBA at night at Northwestern while working at the bank. And read a few books that, again, all the light bulbs come on, but one being Mystery of Capital, if you're familiar with that.
I haven't read that one.
And Hernando de Soto was just looking at land rights and how the poor are sitting on $9 trillion of property and can't access that because they don't have title, or the, you know, it's not recorded at a local county office, where then you could put a mortgage against that recorded deed. And because of that, their capital is dead. And thus they have nothing to borrow against in a normal kind of capital market system. So if you really wanted to help the poor, you'd work on the rule of law, you'd work on property rights, access to property, as well as financial services. And that's really where I started to realize the power of capital, that it does require a legal and financial framework in order for there to be enough, the pipes there to channel toward the poor. And I guess that's where you get excited about working then back into big capital markets sorts of solutions, that if you can get that right, we could really change the world, back to use your phrase. And so we could play a role at creation in that, to show people the way that these clients are bankable, and that there's, you know, 2 billion people that lack access, and here's a market-based solution that can address that, and we can put in hundreds of millions of dollars as a precursor to then billions and billions and soon trillions and trillions, and that will play a role in, not, it's not a panacea,
right?
this is an imperfect world we live in, but it will fundamentally address one of the biggest issues of our day.
I'm sure you have multiple stories, but do you have a story that you could share with us, just of how in the trenches, access to capital for somebody or somewhere has just been so catalytic to their lives or changed them, or however you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think one very powerful moment for me was, I was in India about 10 years ago with a company of ours that was called Grameen Kuta. We were the largest investors in Grameen Kuta. It was a Bangalore-based institution. It's now publicly traded on the Bombay Stock Exchange. It's done amazing work. But we were doing basic microloans to women only, so $200 loans. But we were just starting to launch a product where we would lend for sanitation, toilet loans. Now, Grameen Kuta, through our time of ownership, I think did 800,000 toilet or sanitation loans on top of our microcredit loans. And I met with a family. We went and sat in their home, which was really lovely. And it was a very small home, of course, incredibly modest, dirt floor. But talking with the family about how dangerous it is to use the public toilet, and that this is where people get attacked, and to be able to add a toilet and sewer access, which was a couple $100 on top of. But that really changed their sense of safety and security, as well as the value of their home, all these things that you could never realize. And I was reminded of a quote by our leader there, Suresh, who quoted Mahatma Gandhi, of all people, who Gandhi said that sanitation, public sanitation, was more important than democracy for India.
Oh my gosh, wow.
Which, when Mahatma Gandhi says we need toilets more than, you know, free voting, it tells you something that we're getting at the core of some of the biggest issues that people deal with on a day-to-day basis, and it helps with health, and frankly, some of these borrowers turned these toilets into a business. So we went back and visited, and they, through an 800 something dollar loan, you had a sort of a standalone porta potty that had a lock and a light, and you'd have a monitor there, and there'd be a line. And again, this sounds all strange, and it's a little personal to talk about, you know, potty kind of issue, but these all of us need it, and to do it and to create it into a business, even for folks to have a safe place to and a clean place. It's a part of WASH, as I'm sure you're familiar now. But I didn't realize what we were getting into until I met with this family and this woman, who you know, as I was sitting on the floor just looking at her, helped me understand a whole lot that I couldn't possibly without meeting with her.
So it's interesting. I was at a conference maybe 6 years ago, and it was a bunch of people from across the world, for that matter, talking about different impact themes and issues. And I remember there was a session about women and their cycles and hygiene, and just waking up to the realization of, oh my gosh, because, you know, these number of these places didn't have the necessary sanitary products, these poor women or girls, women wouldn't, I mean, for that week or whatever, they come out of school, then they get behind, and just, you're like, wow, what we take for granted here, and what a blessing that we have. Now, on the other side, there, unfortunately, there are people here in the U.S. who don't have access to a lot of the same things that we take for granted. So,
But I think your point there is right. And for all your listeners, I hope they take that word access and let that be the driving force behind thinking in these places. How do we give people access to education, healthcare, housing, work and employment, capital, financial services, including insurance, which is, how do I manage risk, transportation, political access, social access? I mean, it's just such a great word. And then whatever it is that you're great at, whatever your expertise is in, focus on using that to help people that couldn't before you get access.
Right.
And that may be right here in America, giving somebody an internship that didn't have access, maybe because of their skin color or where they went to school. They didn't go to Harvard. They went to the University of Illinois, Chicago. But give somebody access to your network, you know? So I just think it's such a great word.
I think we've probably talked about this again. I've got a passion for those who are formerly incarcerated. And what I find myself doing is opening up my relationship database, you know, in my brain, and just trying to give access to, hey, you need to meet this person. You need to meet this person. Not that I'm single-handedly changing the world, but what you realize is you've been locked away for X amount of time. I mean, just come back into this world and try to get ahead is just so challenging. So yeah, that access, especially on the relationship side, is just huge. All right, so we've talked about capital, and I don't know if this is the opposite of capital, but how do you think about stewardship, and what does that mean to you?
I mean, stewardship, I think, fundamentally means it's not yours,
okay,
but it's yours to manage for the time that you have it. And stewardship means that you recognize that it's somebody else's, and maybe, again, out of a place of faith, it's God's, or out of a maybe more humanitarian focus, that it collectively belongs to our community or society, which is the stakeholder version of capitalism. But our own stewardship also isn't just money; it's our other forms of intellect. And back to capital, what are all the forms of capital? There's intellectual capital and social capital. So stewardship means how you spend your time as well as where you spend your money. So, you know, for us, I think, you know, maybe to apply stewardship, it would be probably wrong for maybe investors listening to this. to put 100% of their investment portfolio into our stuff or somebody, because that's not a really good idea from a stewardship standpoint. Diversification is probably a good principle there. But also, you know, investing your capital without thinking about its uses and what companies you're behind, whether it be, you know, from a vice or sin stock, a negative screen standpoint, or to be a part of alongside something you believe in. I think part of being a steward is thoroughly evaluating, you know, where you're spending your capital, whether it be through your job or through your volunteering or through your investment portfolio. So for us, we've been stewards also through, I'd say, modest living. You know, one of the ways my wife and I, you know, she came up through a very German home of, you know, if it's not hard, it's not right. It's kind of the analogy that they use. So very, very used to self-discipline and deferred gratification. And I very much believe and enjoy, you know, simplicity and living simply. So, you know, we have one used car, we walk places, we shop, we cut coupons and just because of that, we've always had a lot of excess income to be able to either give or invest. And we've had a lot of margin in life because of how we've lived, where I understand a lot of people, I think, because of maybe some things they can control and some things they can't, but are unable to maybe make some of the stewardship decisions because they haven't managed their life in such a way. So I think simplicity has been a big, big part of the flexibility we've had to be able to adjust and address opportunities.
So it sounds like you personally have maybe challenged the American dream of living in a X amount of house with a white picket fence.
Definitely. Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, again, I'm very blessed to have a wife who shares the same view as I do, which is, you know, we enjoy people above things, and we want to be a part of causes above things. And we're really content with what we have. And it goes back to maybe one of the points I was making about changing the world, that ultimately when I get a resume, and you get resumes too, but people that say, I hate what I do now, but if I worked in what you're, you know, if I worked with you, I'd be happy. It's the old expression, you know, wherever you go, there you are. Mm-hmm. You know, if you have to achieve a level of contentment where you are, and then you can do the next thing and bring that with you. So, but yeah, we, you know, we enjoy things just like a normal person, but we also don't think about them a whole lot. And it's part of why we live maybe in Chicago versus Southern California, for example, because I think some of the cultures that people live in will push, you know, the externals maybe more than the internals, but that can happen anywhere. Yep. So again, I don't want to blame anything on you know, the environment, but it's important to be around others that share that same view.
If you could make one dream come true for your life, what would it be?
For my personal life?
However you, okay. Yeah, sure.
That's a great question. Well, I you know, I guess I'll say I love to travel, if it's really, on my own. And, you know, I've been to a lot of countries and had many blessings of travel, but I'd love to keep traveling for the rest of my life. I'd love to visit people. I love learning, and there's no better way to learn, than to travel. I mean, it's like the old Augustine quote, which is the world is a book, and he who doesn't travel only reads one page.
Any place you've not been that you want to go to?
You know, there are a couple of big gaps. I've never been to Greece, even though I'm an ancient history buff, and I've never been to Australia, which is sad. But
have you been to New Zealand?
I have not. So yeah, I would add those two together. Yeah, you gotta do them together, but yeah, you know, I'd say I'd put those two at the top of my list, although they're pretty developed. Yeah. You know, generally, but yeah, I love to travel. So I guess a dream is to keep traveling and to keep learning and seeing, and through that, then you start to understand what the challenges and also the beauty of this world is. So anyway,
how many miles do you travel a year? Do you know?
I don't know, especially with the pandemic. You know, it went to zero.
A normal world, what were you traveling?
150 to 200, maybe
Yeah.
thousand. Yeah, but I've been traveling and again learning how to manage as a leader of an organization of fabulous people, and we've set up offices in Mexico and India, as you're aware, Jeff. So my travel is much more tactical now. It
Okay.
used to be fly, stay there for 3 weeks through a due diligence and all that. And now I have my teams do that and utilize a lot of different resources. So I now kind of fly in to be there for a couple days, which I think my family appreciates. But I'm also trying to cover more territory as we've
Yeah.
specialized our team. We have a Latin America team who are all Spanish speaking, and wonderful. And then an Asia, India team. And so that specialization makes the travel a little bit easier for everybody.
I don't want to take any more of your time, so we appreciate your insights, your knowledge. I also want to say to you, when I think of you and when I talk to you, your career was from the head. I mean, you were squarely in that institutional world, and yet it's been so fun. Not that I knew you before this, but it's been fun to watch you integrate the head and the heart, and really be excellent on both of
Oh,
those. And I
thanks.
look at what you guys have done, and it really is a standout in the impact community. Not only what you're doing for investors, but then also what you're doing for your clients, your customers
Yeah.
who get access to capital.
Yeah, well, thanks. Well, we have, again, yeah, we've got sort of a dual role. One is first and foremost the clients themselves. That's why we're here, as well as then the management teams within these companies. I mean, there's tremendous impact with us building the leadership capabilities of these management teams who are going to become, because we give ESOPs and ownership to these amazing women and men in our business, they're going to be the next upper class that are going to play out through the generations. But then on the other side, how do we help really build the industry of impact investing? And what I keep saying is show some great returns, some great financial returns to prove that this is real. That there really is no trade-off, a not mutually exclusive view of this. And then I think about just using kind of a non-government private markets capital, approach, market-based approach to solve some of the biggest problems of our day. And that's very exciting. So if we can do that, and we've had good deals and great deals, and we've had bad deals, and if you aggregate it all together,
Right.
it's been a fabulous investment to be a part of. And I only hope that all the other again, industries like clean energy and education and healthcare and all can have some of the same successes that financial services for the poor and the unbanked have had. It's volatile, we're lots of ups and downs, but stick with this. All your investors should not just go into one fund or one deal. You pick a team, pick a sleeve, and continue to invest because the opportunities will play out. And so stay in for the long haul.
Yeah, last comment I'll make is I think we often forget just what a privilege it is to even be able to invest, let alone go through whatever brokerage you want to for as little as $10. You can pretty much buy something. But it really is, I mean, obviously you're dealing with the underbanked, and so obviously that's on the banking side, but we have such an amazing investment array at our fingertips that I think we sometimes lose the how amazingly special it is to have that, and then just the impact that that capital can have. So if somebody works with an underbanked, I'm assuming you see that every day out there.
But I think it plays into what you do, Jeff, which is helping advise, institutions or individuals
Yeah.
or RIAs, and how to then you comb through the thousands and thousands of investment opportunities to find the right ones that aren't greenwash on the ESG side and are having real tangible impact, but also, are hitting the financial goals. So and we're awash, just like with the internet. There's so much out there. Now the
Yep.
challenge is how do you cull through it to find out what's true and what's real? And so you need help. So anyhow, I'm grateful for you.
Well, thank you. And so don't forget to subscribe to New Lens with Common Good Capital on your podcast app of choice. And please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spotify. This will help new investors find the show and hopefully put them on a path to a more fulfilling portfolio within the impact investing space. I'm Jeff Schaefer. Until next time. This podcast is a production of Common Good Capital and does not constitute an offer or a solicitation of an offer. Such offer would only be made through a private placement memorandum. Prospective investors in private placement securities should be aware that making an investment is speculative and involves a high degree of risk, including the risk of losing all or a portion of an investment. Investments of this nature are illiquid and subject to substantial restrictions upon transferability.